Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we bring you a Hanaho show, looking back at 2025. We picked out a few of our interviews on some of the year's biggest stories. We expect that these conversations will remain relevant in the new year. We take you to an international military exercise and hear what officials have to say on the issue of expiring land leases. We talk tariffs, we learn about the history of tariffs in Hawaii, and connect the dots between import taxes and the overthrow of the monarchy. Plus, we look at how one wildlife refuge weathered the storm of federal firings and the longest ever government shutdown. We take you to the slopes of Mauna Kea. And we remember the Falls of Clyde, the historic ship no longer, after decades of back and forth over saving it or scuttling it. It was towed from Honolulu Harbor. It now rests on the ocean floor. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. What to do over expiring military land leases? Throughout 2025, we spoke with activists, military officials, and Governor Josh Green about the topic. Key leases underlying Pohakaloa Training Area on the Big Island and parts of Makua Valley are set to expire in 2029. As talks between the state and the military continue into 2026, we want to take you back to an international military exercise that took place in November. Residents from the island of Hawaii reported hearing rocket fire, and here on Oahu, the sounds of helicopters filled the night sky. Troops from six different countries were involved in the training exercises. It was an opportunity to test out new technology alongside old technology. HPR was out on the training range to witness some of the action. Hundreds of drones are in the skies during the exercise. In 2025, the Army received the first of 16 long-range missiles called HIMARS launchers. It stands for High Mobility Artillery Rocket System. The units are essentially rockets on trucks with a missile range of over 150 miles. They, along with the unmanned aerial systems, those drones we mentioned, are part of the modernization of the way the military fights. They are lessons learned from the war between Russia and Ukraine. We hanaho our conversation with Schofield Army Division Commanding General James Bartholomew and Sergeant Major Sean Curry about how limits on live firing might impact our military's readiness.
We had on Kaikahele, OHA Chairman and former Congressman, and he is pushing to get question out there to the voters about banning live fire training in Hawaii. If that were to happen, what would your options be?
Yeah, so first I'd say we were honored to host Kaikahele twice over the last month and with OHA, and we appreciate the opportunity to engage. And we welcome any groups that would like to come visit. We actually have had a number of visits. And so in our engagements with Kaikahele, and specifically to this question, a quarter of the live fire training that occurs at Hawaii Island is the Hawaii Army National Guard. And so our Hawaii Guard would be probably the most impacted by any sort of requirements to do this. Guam has this problem right now because they're limited on where they can live fire. And so the cost to train, the time away for their soldiers, the op tempo and the strain on forces is already a consideration. And the same would go for the other joint forces. Finally, in terms of our positioning, our strategic positioning and our ability to train, we carefully manage all the resources that we get. We carefully manage any of the training that we do and work closely with the state.
As we talked about with innovation, you know, as military tech and weaponeering has advanced, the number of actual explosive rounds that is fired has significantly reduced, close to 90%. And so the environmental impact is also reduced. But just a quick reminder of history. So the 100th, that battalion, if you fly through H&L, you'll walk past a big memorial for them. They are, per capita, the most Medal of Honors and most Purple Hearts of any unit in the United States Army. They trained right here. They were local Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders who volunteered to serve during World War II, and they trained on these islands to become that unit. Now, they didn't fight in the Pacific. They went off into Europe. You know, and we need to make sure that our service members are prepared, if required, to support and defend our Constitution, to do that, to the realities of war. There is a cost if it is not done here. And that cost could be time away from home, could be time away from being here and doing the things we do with our community. It definitely would have, as an Army, I think we'd work with each other to make sure that we can make sure that that happens.
And then just a follow-up question, you know, with the HIMAR system and all the other training that we're doing, is that really something that we would be called to use, you know, in Taiwan? It works in Europe, but realistically.
So Admiral Paparo, our Indo-PACOM commander during our Land Pacific Conference, stated the number one requirement that he sees as the combatant commander of this theater from the United States Army is long-range fires. So that's his validation as a combatant commander of what he needs Army forces to do. And with the value of any long-range fires, not only of our forces, but of the adversaries, this is absolutely a requirement that we need to have and that we need to continue to train on.
The media got a chance to see troops testing out glider drones with advanced radar. They are also one-way kamikaze drones in use. And we also got a tour of an innovation lab where troops are learning how to build drones out in the field. The Army says it's a glimpse of the future of battlefields, and mobility is key. Here's Bartholomew's and Curry again.
The reality that we live in is that the threats that land forces will deal with, just like our naval and our air, are truly multi-domain. And that's in alignment with our Army's new doctrine of multi-domain operations of air, land, sea, space, and cyber. And so we practice all five of those domains in this exercise through the scenario. And so all these elements are all working together in order to achieve a common goal.
Our combat training centers are updating the way the opposing force fights. And so ours presents a opposing force that is 1 year ahead in technological formation.
Right.
So they have a year advantage on capabilities, skills, drones, electromagnetic spectrum warfare. They've had a year to train in advance of this new formation that just formed, right? And so it's a very hard fight. Both units have trained in the terrain, but the terrain, as most of you know, is unforgiving. So if they aren't prepared to go through the gulches in the Kahukus, it will be a significant emotional event for those soldiers. But our opposing force has spent the last year perfecting their skills. And so now you've got to fight somebody who's really ready and willing.
And they've just recently returned from the previous pathway, so they have the experience
of
help.
Yeah, of being in deep jungle.
It's a natural sparring partner.
That's right.
I think the other thing I mentioned, though not directly related to your question, but I just want to provide, you know, an emphasis on this because you'll see a little bit of it today, is the scope and the scale of the unmanned aerial systems that we're flying out there compared to previous years.
Incredible.
We have over 500 drones that are flying out there in airspace that we coordinate with the FAA in order to safely fly and contest. So you essentially have drone-on-drone fights that are occurring, which is, we think, the reality of the future of warfare. And so getting to do this while also in the gritty, challenging jungle environment and then in the tough terrain of Pualkoloa Training Area is proving to be an excellent environment to train UAS, counter-UAS, as well as electronic warfare, which are really kind of the foundational elements of transformation and contact from our Army.
We're trying to train our teams to make contact with electronics or robots first. You know, the soldier is a precious commodity. And so in order to protect them or give them more protection on the battlefield, we want to detect the enemy earlier. We want to attack and defeat the enemy earlier so that when it comes time for the human-to-human contact, we're on level playing fields.
The Army only recently refocused its training back in the Pacific, and we plan to keep our finger on the pulse of military readiness and the land lease talks into 2026. think about the words that define 2025. Was tariffs one of them? President Donald Trump announced a package of tariffs on April 2nd, a day that he called Liberation Day. Markets swung and businesses fretted over facing new fees for manufacturing and importing goods abroad. But long before Trump began using tariffs as a bargaining strategy, the Kingdom of Hawaii wrestled with the question of how to use tariffs. In fact, tariffs played a central role in the overthrow of the monarchy. Historian and author Ronald Williams Jr. spoke with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about the long history of tariffs in Hawaii, which he says charted the path to annexation.
Tariffs started actually before the creation of the formal kingdom. You know, the kingdom is started in 1840. We moved from an absolute monarchy, kind of a divine monarchy, into a constitutional monarchy. That time before, one of my professors coined the term oivi vale, the native-only period. He didn't like to focus on Captain Cook and call it pre-Cook and post-Cook. So he calls it the oivi vale, the native-only period. And in that period, we had a system of taxes. There were ahupua'a. Yeah, that term's familiar to many people. Well, that literally was an ahu. That was an altar where the po'a'a, the pig, was given. And that was symbolic of taxes that were given to the mo'i, or the king, as he circled the island every year. There was a spiritual side of this also, though. It wasn't just economic. This was the people giving taxes and giving their best fish and giving their best pig and so forth to their ali'i so that their ali'i could bargain for them with the gods, right? It wasn't this kind of European style of, you know, government and taxes and so forth. It was, we want to give our guy stuff so he's powerful enough to go get good crops for us and good rain and so forth from the gods.
Really tapping in that divine element.
Right, yeah. It definitely was a tax. You had to pay it. But it was also this means of kind of reaching out and getting stuff for yourself. So then we move into the kingdom period, the 1840 kingdom period. And really quickly, in 1843, actually, France and England signed the Declaration of Recognition of Hawaii as an independent and sovereign nation, the first brown nation in the world to achieve that recognition. And that really opens up Hawaii to trade. Now, geographically, it's right in the center of the Pacific, incredibly important spot between America and Asia. And we start to see the economy of Hawaii, right? Because they're accepting tariffs and so forth on goods that are coming in. So we start to see the economy of Hawaii really just take off. And there was an article I did a while back on kingdom coins. I found a broadside in the Hawaii State Archives that was listing the currencies that were accepted as legal currency in Hawaii. And this was 1848, and there were 151 currencies.
Whoa.
I mean, I didn't know there were 151 currencies in the world, but,
yeah.
But all of that type of economic activity is going on through Hawaii. So they kind of have to make a decision. You know, do we tax the people to gain revenue, or do we tariff goods that are coming into the kingdom? And they really side on that side of tariffs, trying to keep taxes relatively low for the people. And that's what pays for the roads and the hospitals and all that type of thing. So we start to see that as the tariff as kind of a way to support the economy of the Kingdom of Hawaii without taxing the people too heavily.
And as I understand it, when we get to the 1860s or thereabouts, we start to have a debate about tariffs versus taxes, right? Some tension there.
Right. And it's, yes. And there's a woman on Ni'ihau. She sews mats, the famous Ni'ihau mats. And she sews a mat, and into the mat, she sews a protest of taxes that she's taxed. So we see these, you know, tax protests in the 1860s in Hawaii. And so that really brings to the fore this kind of conversation about, you know, do we increase tariffs even further? Do we tax our people more and so forth? And we start to see in the 1860s, that's really the inflection point for when the kingdom was lost, was the 60s. And, you know, to back up a little bit, the Hawaiian board, the missionaries that were coming from Boston, they cut off support for the local association in 1863. They said, you've done your job, you've Christianized the nation. You know, now you guys come home and turn the churches and the government over to the Hawaiian people. And many of the missionaries didn't want to. Missionary sons. Now, this it's important to make that distinction. You know, we kind of blame missionaries for a lot, but the actual missionaries were mostly, you know, gone by this point. This was the sons and the grandsons of the mission. And they have positions in society that are very powerful. You know, they've gone into business, they're running the church and so forth, and they don't necessarily want to give that up, especially since they've gone to school back east in the 1850s and 60s, the time of Darwin and Manifest Destiny and that type of thing. So we start to bring race into the question. And they say, well, white folks should rule Hawaii. So in the 1860s, you see this group of sons of mission. It's important also to note, these aren't Americans. We always say the American overthrowing the American this. These are Hawaiian Kingdom subjects, born and raised in Hawaii. Many of them never been to America. Now, of course, they've got an American legacy, but it's important to note that they have their allegiance. They've signed their oath of allegiance to the Hawaiian Kingdom, and they decide that they want to keep their positions. And so they push this idea of not only of tariffs on incoming goods, but they're starting to push the big idea of their main crop, which is sugar, being not tariffed when it goes into the United States as a foreign good. And so they start to push this idea of a treaty of reciprocity between the Hawaiian Kingdom and the United States, where the sugar tariff will be taken off. And at this point, they're already, several of them are already literal millionaires. You know, today's terms, you're probably talking billionaires. So these are the richest people in the country. And they're making the argument that if you allow us this move to take off the tariff on sugar going to the United States, then that riches that we make will trickle down to the people.
Yeah, so the earliest iteration of Reagan's famous trickle-down economics.
Exactly.
There. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, what did the Treaty of Reciprocity eventually lead to? We have that sort of inflection point. Where does that take the kingdom at that point?
Yeah. So the original Treaty of Reciprocity, this is also confused quite a bit. The original Treaty of Reciprocity did not offer Pearl Harbor. It was originally in that first treaty. The people rose up and said no. There were mass meetings. We call them Halawai Maka'anana in the Hawaiian language papers. There were mass meetings around the country saying, no, we do not give up territory and we don't give exclusive rights to any country. And so the people rose up and said no. Kalakaua, who had been elected in 74, kind of on the back of the American businessman, even he said no. He said, well, no, we're not going to do this. And so that idea of giving away Pearl Harbor for the removal of the tax on sugar kind of falls away. And the Treaty of Reciprocity that Kalakaua signs in Washington in 1874 takes tariffs off of certain goods from the United States and certain goods from Hawaii. So it's really just a, we won't tax your sugar and your corn and your coffee and so forth on both sides. So it does enrich those folks in Hawaii, but it doesn't yet give away Pearl Harbor. But the key is that it has an end date. Yeah. And so moving into the 1880s, we start to see this nervousness by the sugar companies. We really need that tariff taken off again, you know, to renew the treaty. And the United States says they don't want to renew the treaty. They say it's not a good treaty for us. It's unfair on our side and so forth. To renew this, we're going to have Pearl Harbor. And so the missionary sons and the American businessmen, there are some American businessmen in Hawaii, they kind of understand that they can't afford to let this die. And the Kalakaua is against it. He has kind of seen the light. You know, I like to say that Kalakaua had a Saul-like moment. Mm. I mean, he really was on the side of the American businessman. He was making money himself on sugar. And I think one day he kind of had this understanding, whoa, they're getting so powerful, they don't need me anymore.
Right.
And that's when he kind of turns 180 degree, you know, into that position. But nonetheless, he's saying, no, I'm not going to sign the new treaty. So they've got to do something. So in 1887, they literally have a coup. And the Sons of the Mission and the local white businessmen get together. They had formed a secret group called the Hawaiian League. We have their first oath book. We have their membership book. And it's all the names you remember. It's Castles and the Cooks and the Athertons and the Baldwins and so forth. And they sign an oath to support the white community of Honolulu against the native monarchy. They get a small militia under their control, and they literally enact a coup on July 6th, 1887, taking over the government, making the Mo'i, the king, basically a figurehead, and they renew that Treaty of Reciprocity with the United States.
All of this driven by tariffs.
Exactly, exactly.
Kind of alarming for today's atmosphere that we're living in right now. Mm-hmm. So, and then McKinley really puts the final nail in the coffin, if you will, in the 1890s by, in fact, putting tariffs on sugar.
Right. So the McKinley Act passes, and that reenacts the sugar tariff on the sugar coming from Hawaii, and that puts a real dent. You know, we start to see a fall in the stock market that you know, as we talk about, that happens in 1890 in Hawaii.
So it sounds to me what you're saying, when tariffs are turned into international bargaining tool, this seems like the moment that the kingdom was lost.
Right, right. And so people, you know, it's not that tariffs are good or bad. It's how they're used. If we look at Kalakaua and the use of tariffs in that period, and not only tariffs, but international diplomacy. Nowadays, I you know, we've heard a lot lately about waste and fraud in the government and so forth, and that's our biggest problem, not tariffs. Well, in the kingdom, if you read the English language newspapers, they were saying the same thing in that period. You know, they were basically setting up what they were going to do. And when Kalakaua built the Iolani Palace, it cost $300,000, a lot of money at that time. And the English language papers almost unanimously say, what a waste. You know, he's got an ego. He's building this palace for himself and so forth. But if you dive into the Hawaiian language newspapers and you dive into the personal writings of himself and other leaders of the time, they say the palace is international architectural testimony to nationhood. The people that come to Hawaii to visit Hawaii, the other diplomats and the world leaders and so forth, cannot but remember that Hawaii is a sovereign, independent nation because of this palace. Kalakaua takes a trip around the world. Oh, great, he's going on a vacation. No, he's going around to sign treaties, to set up consulates. In the 19th century, there were 136 different consulates, Hawaiian Kingdom consulates around the world on six continents. And these weren't just for show. These were places that protected Hawaiian Kingdom subjects. I can give you a little story. There's a group of Hawaiian whalers who get off a ship in Port Townsend near Seattle, and the captain refuses to pay them. I mean, you know, 13 brown guys in the middle of this wild territory, who cares? I'm not going to pay them. Well, they'd be out of luck if there wasn't a Hawaiian Kingdom consulate in Port Townsend, which there was.
Right.
So they go to the Hawaiian Kingdom consulate, they tell their story, the consulate contacts the Supreme Court for the Territory of Washington, and they get these gentlemen to pay, right? So it's a literal protection of Hawaiian Kingdom subjects abroad. These are the types of things that Kalakaua is doing. He's building a foundation for a strong nation. The sugar growers and the white local businessmen are kind of pushing back and realizing that they're going to have to actually seize power from him.
People of Hawaii knew they had their kingdom. They knew the community and culture in which they lived, but it had to be projected out to the world.
Exactly, exactly. If you look back through time, as a historian, I've been digging this issue for about 20 years in Hawaii, and the Hawaiian Kingdom was one of the most progressive modern nations on Earth. I mean, it really isn't. There's a checklist I have of facts that I wish were taught in the schools that really kind of surprise most people. In 1840, when we have that constitutional monarchy created, there is a woman, Kekaulu Ohi, who's put in as a Supreme Court justice. And I ask, you know, audiences, I talk about, when was the first Supreme Court justice in the United States? Sandra Day O'Connor, 1981. 140 years prior, the kingdom had a woman Supreme Court justice. They had women governors. They had women in the House of Nobles. 1852, the Constitution for Hawaii has universal manhood suffrage. This is a decade before the U.S. Civil War, when 600,000 men are dying over whether or not to own black folks. And in Hawaii, any race on earth could come to Hawaii, become citizens, and own property and vote. So you have this building of an incredible progressive nation, and then a small oligarchy of white men decide they need to run it, and they use tariffs and other, you know, machinations to do that.
That last sentence sounded a little hauntingly familiar. So given that what you just said, you know, how do you see this history informing us now as we all try to understand how the Trump administration is using tariffs? I mean, I realize you're not an economist, but,
right.
But from a historical perspective, what lessons do you see there?
Right. I'm not an economist. I'm also not a political scientist. I always try to remind people that I don't know what to do. I can just tell you what happened in the past. But having said that, yes, I mean, as an individual, you look and see the news and you see this idea of using tariffs as a sword to get other countries to bend to our will. And that's exactly what had happened here in Hawaii. Once we put all of our desires or all of our faith in the use of tariffs, then the kingdom was lost. You know, once we see that 1890 McKinley bill come in, we see that small group of men who had enacted that first coup understand that they've got to stop messing around and they've got to make the big move, which is overthrow the queen, take over the kingdom, become annexed to the United States. Because once they become annexed to the United States, there's no longer an importation of foreign goods. They're in American territory.
That was historian Ronald Williams Jr. speaking with HPR's D.W. Gibson last April. Williams works at the State Archives, where many of the documents he referenced can be viewed. You are tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Today's Hana Ho Show looks back at 2025, issues that will continue into the new year. Stay with us. Coming up after the break, how federal layoffs and the longest ever government shutdown affected one Hawaii Island wildlife refuge.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Distance Learning Executive MBA and Master of HR Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
Aloha, my name is Terry Heckman. I'm a retired librarian, and I'm a proud and long supporter of Hawaii Public Radio. HPR is such an important part of our community. It's a great place to get news that presents both sides of the story. It's not sensationalizing it. It's actually getting to the meat of the matter and trying to help us understand what is happening.
Become a member today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Monkey Pot Kitchen in Waikiki, Ko'olina, Wailea, and Ka'anapali, and from Moku Kitchen on Oahu, the Beach House on Kauai, and Ulu Kitchen on Maui, featuring live music nightly.
on the conversation, we took you out to a critical habitat for endangered native birds on the island of Hawaii. We wanted to see how decisions at the federal level were impacting conservation efforts locally. The Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge could not seem to catch a break in 2025. In March, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency fired half of the field team. They were later reinstated, but some senior staff members opted for retirement, leaving the refuge without a full-time maintenance team. Remaining workers were furloughed during the government shutdown, and in November, a brush fire on the slopes of Mauna Kea burned more than 2,000 acres before it was contained. It narrowly missed the boundary of the refuge. The Conversation's Maddie Bender visited Hakalau in September on the one day a year that it was open to the public.
All right. Thank you so much for coming out to join us and our friends group as we celebrate our 40th anniversary as a refuge.
Leah Messer addresses a crowd in an open field at the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge. Just hours before, the only occupants of the field were a group of nene. Now, volunteers direct four-wheel drive vehicles to overflow parking, and 500 pairs of hiking boots flatten the grass, still slick with the morning's dew. Today is the only day all year that the refuge is open to the public. The nonprofit Friends of the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge runs the event as a way to bring new faces to the refuge and re-engage old friends. Much like in past years, the Find Your Wild event is at capacity. But this year is extra special. It marks the 40th anniversary that the Hakalau Forest has been managed as a national wildlife refuge by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The milestone has put everyone in a reflective mood, including Springer Kay, who's the interim manager of the refuge.
Well, you know, the annual event here is always feels like a family reunion. You know, I was an intern here in 1999. So some of the folks that are volunteering or on the board of the Friends of Hakalau were my mentors back then when I was in my 20s. And so it's really special to just walk through, walk down the road, see everyone enjoying the forest so much, and really notice the changes. When I was an intern, you had to hike hours down into the forest, into the deepest parts of the forest to see an Akeopola owl or an olivee, our endangered forest birds. And today, as I left the parking area to just start down the walk, I was able to show a whole group of visitors an olivee foraging just 10 feet off the side of the road in koa that are probably 4 inches in diameter. So trees that were planted less than 10 years ago are providing habitat for our endangered forest birds, and that's just really exciting.
The forest has a remarkable history, and the people gathering at Find Your Wild are celebrating what they've accomplished over the past decades. Bill Stormont is a Friends of Hakalau board member. He puts the dramatic difference into perspective.
I remember when this looked like that.
This is radio. You need to describe.
No. Well, the history, right, was, and I'm sure others have shared it with you too, but 50 years ago, there was an effort put forward to do surveys across the state for forest birds. Landmark work, remarkable stuff, and the transects that they laid out, and especially on this island, and just, I mean, crazy places. And spending weeks and weeks on trails, on transects, doing bird counts. And this place was identified as a very important habitat for certain critically endangered forest birds on Hawaii Island. Even without this level of kind of recreated koa forest, there was enough remnant koa and other habitat around for them to still be here. And so that began the effort to designate Hakalau, and that came 10 years later. Staff followed, and then the work began of doing the habitat protection work and the tremendous volunteer work that has happened over the last 35 years of over 700,000 trees planted here, 90% by volunteers. And so, yes, we're standing beneath koa trees and across the road where it hasn't been planted yet is what it used to look like. It's just basically open pasture with a few scattered trees. But here it's almost a closed canopy koa forest with understory components coming in, like the native mints here and the olapa we took a sniff of earlier and the kawa'u. And the native blackberry, So that's all, those components of the ecosystems are now beginning to fill in. And that all adds to the habitat for the birds, because the birds rely on the fruits. The blackberry from the Olapa is a favored food. It's also kappa dye, used for dye. So all that's coming now. So that's the short version of the story of Hakalau.
It's been about a year since I'd last been to the refuge. I spent a weekend there, covering a volunteer-run program called Beginner Bird School. It was supposed to be a heartwarming story about people coming together to appreciate native birds. Then, as I was putting the story together, I heard that the volunteer leader of the program had been fired from his full-time job at the refuge. Half the field staff had been dismissed at an impersonal meeting. Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency directed the Fish and Wildlife Service to make the cuts. Eric Preston Hamron was the Hakalau employee who led Beginner Bird School in a volunteer capacity. He wound up being reinstated after about a month, but the experience rattled the sense of security that many seem to have about Hakalau. The Find Your Wild event being held today is about marking 40 years of the refuge and acknowledging hard-earned successes. But I have other concerns on my mind. What does it take to sustain the gains we've made in conservation? And what happens if that work stops? I pose that question to Bill Storman.
It seems like you and the other folks I've talked to aren't as concerned by the threat of, like, funding lost, staff firings. 40 years means, I guess, you can take the long view and say there have been ups and downs.
Well, you need to. In ecosystem restoration here in the islands, it's a long-term goal. But that takes energy. It takes funding. It takes people. Because you build a fence, you don't walk away. You have to check that fence on a monthly basis. You have to make sure that there aren't any opportunities for the animals that you got out of there to get back in. When you do that, you have to be able to commit long-term, in perpetuity, essentially, to maintaining that. Otherwise, all that effort, all that money that's been put into the beginning of the restoration work is gone.
Staff and volunteers are planning for the future of the refuge, even as they react to a changing political climate that's directly affected their work. The refuge recently opened a new greenhouse, thanks in part to the Friends of Hakalau. The nursery houses around 8,000 native plants in total. I run into a couple familiar faces among neat rows of mamane, ohia, and koa seedlings.
Oh, hi, Maddie.
Hi, Eric.
That's Eric Preston Hamron, who was terminated by DOGE and reinstated. He's back in his role as nursery manager at the refuge and is surprisingly optimistic about the future of the forest.
So I've been here for a year and a half, and native plants grow slow. Native plants grow slow in cold environments, like up here. So it's taken us a year and a half, and we're just getting our first plants ready to go out the door, back planted into the forest. So we've collected the seeds, we've cleaned the seeds, we've sprouted them, potted them, cared for them, and then now our first babies grown in this greenhouse since I've been here, restarting the restoration program and the nursery, getting that back up. And our goal is to get up to 30,000 plants a year.
A spokesperson for the Fish and Wildlife Service said in a statement that the agency does not comment on personnel matters. But Zoe Naumoff is wrapping up a year at the Hakalau Nursery through the nonprofit Kupu. She reflects on the tumult she's seen.
I'm definitely in my feels. Yeah, it's like my last time up here, I think, for a long time. The next time I come up here, it'll be a totally different forest, I hope. So definitely putting me in my feels. It's like saying bye to all my babies.
Over the past year, you've seen your fair share of ups and downs. What's your mood? What's your outlook?
I'm, despite everything going on and all, you know, like, everyone has to be careful about what they say. But I'm really hopeful about this project particularly, just because I know Eric is so committed. Like, even if he does get laid off, he will volunteer his time to come and take care of these plants. He's not going to leave them up here to just be abandoned and die. Like, and he proved that when he got terminated and he kept coming up before he was reinstated again. So I'm confident that the people here are really committed. I'm confident that the community is really committed. Like, we have so many people showing up, so many people donating. That gives me a lot of hope. Like, the people around the project give me a lot of hope.
Bailey Daniels is president of the Hawaii chapter of the Wildlife Society.
She has a similar perspective on the resilience that the employees at the refuge have shown since the Doge cuts.
It's not about money. I mean, if it was about money, I'd be in a completely different career than I'm in. But conservation's more than that. It's about taking care of the land. It's about taking care of everyone that lives there and community. And Hakalau really shows that. And everyone who went through that showed that it's what it's really about, not the money, not the job. It's more than that. It's the love and the passion that they have for this land. And I'm really lucky that I had the opportunity to come up here and be a part of it.
Daniels has a point, but it is a little bit about the money. The Friends of Hakalau are building up a nest egg in the form of a $3.5 million endowment fund. So far, they've raised over $2 million. Board member Ken Kupchak tells me about the plan to ensure a future for the refuge.
We started about 6-7 years ago. And that's the people come, they see it, and they want to contribute. We've got a place for them. And that's designed to help maintain this place if there are gaps in federal budgets and things of that nature. And we picked our target as a number of what it would take to maintain it for a year on it if there was no funding. Well, that would use it all up, so we don't want to do that, but we're working towards that.
So with that endowment fund, did you think, you know, back in March that you would have to tap into that?
Well, what the Friends of Hakalau did is they didn't tap into it because we're trying to reach our maintenance goal. We raised money on the side, and they raised $200,000 in a month. So, and that's sitting there because they haven't had to use it yet. So, yes, many of the refugees and the Friends groups are trying to see what they need to do to bridge the gap if the gap occurs.
In the months after the Doge cuts and reinstatements, 6 of the 17 staff members at the refuge have left. Most of the positions haven't been filled.
The team leader, this deputy team leader, the head of maintenance, and a staff member that was doing all the paperwork. Yeah, we had lunch with them about a week ago.
I mean, it seems, maybe to me, it seems like a no-brainer that there should be a maintenance team, right?
Yes.
I asked Kupchak if he feels like the current uncertainty over staffing and budget is a momentary setback or if it's an existential threat to the refuge. Keep in mind, we spoke before the federal government was shut down for over a month.
I think it's going to be a problem with budgets for everything in the country for the next 3 years.
So what do you want people to do about it?
We're building our endowment to be able to step in if we need to. That's what's happening here. The other refugees aren't as lucky to have a group of people that have raised that kind of money.
A whole lot of money and constant work go into maintaining the perimeter fence around Hakalau. It might not sound flashy, but Kupchak says the fence is key to preserving both the forest and the native species that call it home. If invasive species get in, it's back to square one.
Pigs and goats and the sheep get in, and they multiply so rapidly that all the work we've done to bring them down, we've lost. We have to start over. So I've been making this point in the national basis when they're doing the budgets. We have about 20 refuges that have endangered species, and we can't defer our maintenance beyond 90 days.
We know by now what happened. Between October 1st and November 12th, the federal government was shut down for the longest stretch in U.S. history. All but 2 of the Fish and Wildlife employees at Hakalau were furloughed. I spoke with Pete Stein during the shutdown about its effects. He's a retired Fish and Wildlife Service employee and the current Friends of Hakalau board president.
Since the shutdown, the refuge staff is by and large not working. I mean, I think they have some emergency contingencies that makes some of the staff available for emergencies, but for the most part, they're just not there. You know, we're concerned, of course, because for one thing, they have those 2 greenhouses with all the seedlings in them that needs to be taken care of. You know, it's a big investment. And those seedlings are critical to the outplanting program. And then the pig management, you know, that never goes away. All of the threats that the refuge faces just don't go away. We've made so much progress in adding healthy, productive forest over the many years. All of that has come to somewhat of a halt. You know, who knows what the longer term implications will be, but it's definitely not good for a place that needs care and feeding constantly.
The Friends of Hakalau didn't tap into the endowment they've been building.
not during staff departures or a government shutdown. Hakalau may be the forest the community built, but its survival over the next 40 years may depend on more than the community alone. Stein says the Friends of Hakalau don't see their efforts as a replacement for federal support.
We're there to supplement. We're there to help. But we cannot, and in my opinion, should not be a substitute for the responsibility that the federal government has to operate the refuge. There are laws that direct them to do so. And, you know, so we're not trying to come into the situation and replace that. We're there to supplement and help them.
We've been hearing from Maddie Bender and the staff and community members at the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge. They've been reflecting on how the refuge has weathered uncertainty in their personnel and funding. And a note, Ken and Patty Kupchick, in support of the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, are underwriters of HPR. We close out our Hanaho show remembering those who we lost in 2025, figures like Vice President Dick Cheney, scientist Jane Goodall, and NPR's Susan Stamberg. Locally, we remember Representative Gene Ward, artist Satoru Abe, and musician Fiji, and Hawaii Public Radio music host Ian Capps, and our founding chair of the HPR board, John Henry Felix. 2025 also marked the swan song of the Falls of Clyde. We look back at the last chapter of the historic vessel before the ship was laid to rest some 25 miles off of Oahu's south shore in October. HPR was there at the Aloha Tower just before daybreak as two tugboats hauled the last iron-hulled tanker out into Honolulu Harbor for its final journey. It had been docked at Pier 8 for decades as a struggle to save it and turn it into a museum played out. It had been declared a National Historic Landmark and then delisted in 2024 when efforts to return it to Scotland failed. At 5 a.m. on a dark October morning, a handful of people were dockside to witness the end of a long saga, including Don, a maritime historian with the group the Friends of the Falls of Clyde.
It's a sad day. I wouldn't have missed it. But it was very sad to see it happen. It's sad to look at the Hawaii Maritime Center, or what remains of the Hawaii Maritime Center, and see an empty slip there. Definitely a void.
The state had allowed members of the Friends of Falls of Clyde to bid aloha to the vessel earlier in the week. It was a tough last visit for Bruce McEwen, who we talked to over the years, and who faced this final goodbye with a heavy heart.
After 10 years of trying to get the ship removed, the state finally met its goal. And so that's what made it even more bittersweet, because we known over the years that the outcome could have been different if the state's position would have been different.
And you did try to get her back to Glasgow. You had the group over there make a bid for this.
Right. I mean, we were totally independent from them, but we were supportive of their effort to try to get the ship returned. We thought that would have been actually a very positive result of her removal from the harbor, would be going back to where she was originally built.
And for our listeners who may not be familiar with this vessel, tick down her history.
Well, she was built in Port Glasgow, Scotland in 1878, launched December 12th, 1878. Then, you know, the main connection with Hawaii came in at the turn of the century when Captain Matson bought her to sail between the West Coast and Hawaii. And, of course, that lasted only a fairly short period of time in terms of the life of the ship, because steam took over sail. And then, of course, she went the ownership to some oil companies, and then ended up in Alaska as a bunker barge for the fishing fleet out of Ketchikan. And then everybody felt that her life was ended there. She was brought down to Seattle at that point, thinking she was going to be a part of the breakwater in Vancouver, Canada, and ultimately John Wright and Bob Krause decided, no, she belonged here in back here in Hawaii, and she came back here in 1963, restored initially in the 70s, turned over to Bishop Museum in the late 80s, and by this time, she had historical recognition both for the state and on the national level, and was under the stewardship of Bishop Museum from about 1989 until the museum gave her up in 2008, and then that's when we stepped in.
Well, I just remember being there at Aloha Tower when the Italian ship, the Amerigo Vespucci,
right,
was docked there, and it was such a juxtaposition of a historic ship with all the backing and in tip-top shape, still in use, and then to look over there to the other side of the pier and see the Falls of Clyde languishing.
Yeah, you know, obviously we felt bad about it because she was under our stewardship at that point in time, but it was the prior owner neglect that got her in that condition.
You know, I guess as you look back on this, I mean, you tried everything you could to save her, but that was not to be.
We entered this whole project back when we took possession in 2008. We thought, and somewhat naively, I guess, that if we learned about the technical aspects of restoring a historical ship, that we would be successful. And at the end of 2014, we thought we had the proper strategy in place. We had a dry dock plan from a well-respected engineering company. We had a business plan that made it clear that once the dry dock was done and her hull was stable, that we would phase in restoration of the ship over a period of decades. That's, again, being probably too naive. We felt that that made enough sense that the state would support us. And then, of course, starting at the end of 2014, when they ignored both the business plan and the dry dock plan, in 2015, they started their campaign to undermine our work and get rid of the ship.
That was Bruce McEwen with Friends of the Falls of Clyde. And Deputy Harbors Director Dre Khalili was on scene bright and early at the docks to see the saga of the vessel come to an end.
It is gone. We've just watched it sail across the turning basin and through the harbor entrance, and we can just barely see it approaching the horizon. It's definitely, you know, an occasion with mixed, I think, emotions and thoughts about this. But I think from this standpoint, we can say the removal from the harbor has occurred. It's something that we felt needed to happen, given the deteriorating condition of the vessel. And that decision is what has brought us here today. You know, there are mixed thoughts and emotions with this, but we really were focused on just keeping the port safe. It's incredibly important to our islands, to our state economy. But I think the important thing is, in terms of preserving the history and memorializing this vessel that was here in our harbors and served our islands when it did, we will be installing a permanent display to memorialize the ship. We recovered some of the artifacts from the vessel, so those will be on display within the year. And I think another thing of importance is there is another Scottish-built ship that is in the San Francisco Maritime Museum, and some of the artifacts from the vessel have been transferred to the museum. It will be part of their interpretation and their display of the Balclutha, and some of the rigging tools that were removed from the Falls of Clyde will be used to rig and maintain that vessel. So I think there is still life of the Falls of Clyde that will continue, well, not in Hawaii, but, you know, its history will be remembered and celebrated.
That was State Harbors Deputy Dre Khalili, who was at the Aloha Tower Marketplace to watch the towing of the historic Falls of Clyde ship out of Honolulu. The ship turned 147 years old on December 12th, 2025. Thank you. And that does it for today's special showcase highlighting some of the top stories of 2025. We would like to hear from you. You can comment on our Facebook or Instagram pages or call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And you can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our show's produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HBR Digital team. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up The Conversation.